our next speaker is Elsa Larson. And Elsa has been the program evaluator for the tobacco control program at the Rhode Island Department of Health since November 2014. Prior to this position, she served as the HIV prevention program manager. Elsa has a master's degree in behavioral science and a master's degree in pharmacoepidemiology from the University of Rhode Island, where she is currently a doctoral candidate in behavioral science, focusing on health behavior change and prevention research. And Elsa is going to be giving two presentations.
Yes. I'm going to be giving two back-to-back presentations about tobacco control policy in Providence, so you'll have me for the next 50 minutes. So
sit back, relax.
Yeah, sit back, relax. If you have to stand up, stretch, get warm, do what you need to do. We just want to, at the Department of Health, thank you for coming. This was a very interesting project for us. So the long title is the Systematic Surveillance of Rhode Island's Retail Environment to Audit Point-of-Sale Tobacco Advertising, Placement, and Promotion in 2012. And the short title for this is we did an environmental scan with our community stakeholders to examine the health of our neighborhoods in Rhode Island. And it was a complex process, but we learned a lot, and we're happy to share our findings. So what is the problem? So is this blurry, or is it just me? Okay.
I thought it was me.
I just broke my glasses, so.
Yeah.
All right.
I think it's a video.
It's been blurry for the past.
All right, can you guys work with it?
Yeah.
All right. So,
it's not going to get better. It's like worse.
Okay. So, we started with what's the problem? What do we need to do? So, the problem is tobacco marketing, and this is tobacco marketing. So, kids who see it are more likely to smoke. So what we know is that the tobacco industry's marketing budget far exceeds our counter-marketing budget. Big Tobacco spends about $35 million a year just to market products in Rhode Island. The Rhode Island Department of Health receives about $1 million from CDC from core prevention activities, and only a fraction of that is dedicated to counter-marketing. So this is a tough battle. Since the Master Settlement Agreement in 1998, tobacco marketing has been concentrated in the retail setting or at the point of sale. So this is tobacco marketing. So Big Tobacco spends about 92% of its marketing budget on retail marketing. So they work in cooperation with retailers to secure contracts to get this shelf space right behind the counter. And so products are eye level, by level, in reach of kids, and they're attractive to kids. And we see this with little cigars, like vanilla-flavored black cherry little cigars that are placed at eye level that look like candy and are placed near the candy. So this is tobacco marketing, and this is the problem. The other thing we know is that there's differential exposure to tobacco marketing based on who you are and where you live. And so tobacco marketing is a threat to health equity. And so that's where we started. And we started with this concern, and our community partners had this concern. So eye level is bi-level, from the words of a tobacco executive. What we know is that most smokers start when they're kids. So they start when they're teens. And so tobacco control has really adjusted its strategy to focus on point of sale. In Rhode Island, we've had a lot of success. So Rhode Island's youth cigarette smoking rate is 8%, and that's second in the country to Utah. But even though we've had success with reducing the youth cigarette smoking rate, we are one of four states where youth cigar smokeless or spit tobacco surpasses cigarette use. So though our 2013 cigarette rate was 8%, if you were to combine all tobacco products and look at teens who used at least one of those, that bumps up to about 15%. So these emerging products are a problem for us in a state that is relatively well controlled. Additionally, Rhode Island has the highest self-reported retail youth buy rate in the country at 28%. So that's self-reported from the YRBS. That's not to be confused with the SINAR study. So what is the next frontier for Rhode Island? So for states like Rhode Island that have advanced and strong tobacco control policies, we're really looking at the point of sale. So in addition to our very low youth smoking rate, we also have the third highest cigarette tax in the country, and we can attribute a lot of our success to that. We've had a comprehensive ban on indoor smoking since 2005, so we've made a lot of progress, but the point of sale is the next frontier. So the logic behind it is we want to reduce exposure to tobacco marketing and products by restricting tobacco retailer density, and we want to prevent tobacco initiation among youth. But this is very difficult to do because density is hard to measure unless you get out on the street and visit every single tobacco retailer and figure out how does density vary by neighborhood, how does the prevalence of emerging products vary by neighborhood, how does the prevalence of products on the counter vary by neighborhood, which neighborhoods are at higher risk of having schools in close proximity to tobacco retailers, and the only way to do this is to get out and survey every single store. So what do we already know about Rhode Island's retail environment? So this is how we started. So there's Rhode Island. Has anyone ever been to Rhode Island? Sweet. Okay. So we are a very small state and we're very dense. So what happens in Rhode Island? So if you want to sell tobacco products, you have to get a license from the state. And so there is a tobacco retailer license database that's publicly available on the Department of Administration's website. So what we did in 2012 is take that tobacco retailer list, and it's about 1,300. And you can see in this map that everything kind of starts in Providence and then is dispersed out. So the denser, the lower income is correlated to more tobacco retailers. We know that lower income neighborhoods are more likely to be exposed to higher retail density, more price promotions, more convenience stores. Lower income neighborhoods are more likely to be the neighborhoods that have the schools within eyesight or walking distance of a tobacco retailer, and they're more likely to have convenience stores near schools that offer price promotions and have emerging products. So this really does become a health equity issue. I'm not going to talk about this last bullet because my next talk is going to go all through that. So, priming you, Providence was a success. So what did we want to do? We wanted to prevent young people from being exposed to tobacco marketing. We wanted to engage stakeholders in public health action to protect youth from tobacco marketing. And this is a really important point because a lot of the strength in tobacco control is working with communities, working with stakeholders. And so when we do this kind of work, you don't always get the beautiful, clean surveillance data. And this is one of the lessons learned. The great thing about store audits or environmental scans is it allows us to monitor exposure to tobacco marketing in our communities in real time. Big Tobacco is always switching up their game, always switching up their tactics, and the only way to be on them is to be out and looking at what they do and recording it. So what did we want to know? What kinds of emerging tobacco products are available? Are flavored products available? Are tobacco products placed on the counter, so within reach? Are there tobacco price promotions, so discounts, multi-packs, free gifts? And how many retailers in Rhode Island are close to schools? So those were the guiding questions. So, trying to catch up here. So for the study design, this was a retail store surveillance study. So it's an audit of tobacco products, their placement, promotion, and price. We used a convenience sample of the 1,300 retailers I showed you previously, and I'll talk a bit more about how we came up with that. Our goal was to try to hit every single city and town, but three towns were excluded. Providence was excluded because they had done a retail observation the year before. Anne had recently passed a flavor ban and price discounting ordinance. New Shoreham is Block Island. Has anyone been there? So, the realities of public health, as opposed to big tobacco, is we didn't have the resources to get out there, so that was a practical implication for Block Island. And North Kingstown was excluded due to our partner not having the capacity to do two towns at once. So that was a lesson learned. So we contracted with 16 community partners, so our vendors who were implementing local tobacco control work. And so we had 16 partners, trained staff to go out and actually collect the data. And this, at the time, was considered novel work before the standardized tools came out. So we used the tools that were available and developed our own program-created survey tool. So again, this is before the standardized tools came out. There wasn't a lot of clear guidance on how to do this, but we knew we could not hit 1,300 tobacco retailers, so we had to use a sample. And so the previous program evaluator consulted with CDC, and this is what they came up with. So we started with 1,283 licensed tobacco retailers and had kind of a cutoff. So towns that had more than 40 stores, we did a random selection of 50% of those stores, but towns that had less than 40 retailers, all of them were surveyed. And so that gave us 671 stores for the sample. Of the 671, though, only 501 were able to be analyzed, and the biggest problem here was missing data. So for the survey tool, so we developed a two-page store observation survey tool and user guide. And again, we were looking at these key variables. So what kind of product is it? A little cigar, cigarillo, snuff, dissolvable. How much is it? Is it flavored? What's the brand? Where is it placed, on the counter or behind the counter? And what kind of store is it? Are we at a convenience store, a big supermarket, a local market, a gas station, et cetera? We trained the partners on how to collect the data and also how to behave in the store doing this and how to anticipate any resistance from retailers, because they went in with a clipboard, with their paper survey. Some of them had badges, and for the most part, there weren't any problems, but some retailers did want to know what was going on. And again, the survey was informed by other tools. So each agency got an equal number of stores, and so they were assigned an equal number of stores, and we gave them the surveys, and each survey had a pre-printed address label on it. So they used those surveys and visited the stores with the paper surveys. It took about a month to survey all the stores, and then the staff came back and gave all of these 671 paper surveys to health to extract and dump into an Excel spreadsheet. The biggest problem we had was the surprising amount of missing data. And so our analyses ended up being pretty simple, because what we ended up seeing was this sort of just random missing data. And so there were lots of questions that weren't answered. Most of the questions were yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And for one reason or another, we had a high proportion of missing data with no clear pattern. And so this was a huge challenge for the EPI and evaluators, because we needed to figure out, how do we handle this missing data? How do we deal with the missing data but still be able to tell a story? And so the options were, do we code the missing data as no or not available? And we knew if we did that, then we would underestimate the prevalence of the product. But on the other hand, if we were to just use different denominators, this also caused a little bit of a mess. So, for example, we have an analytic sample of 501 stores. There's a question on the form that says, does the store sell flavored Cheyenne little cigars? Yes or no? So only 274 surveys came back with any data. So 227 of those were left blank. You see where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
I saw a bunch of like. So the decision was, so do we use 501 as the denominator, and we only have 160 that showed that the product was there, and so then that would tell us that 31% of these stores had Cheyennes. On the other hand, if we use 274 as the denominator, that bumps up to 58%. So we decided to go that route to tell a more meaningful story, but I'll show you what it looks like when you do that. So after the missing data procedures were established and developed, basic frequencies and crosstabs were run to look at the number of stores with emerging products, flavored products, price discounts, or on-counter products, and then they were crosstabbed by what kind of store is this, a national store or a local kind of mom-and-pop convenience store. And then we did some very simple mapping and spatial analysis using ArcGIS. So what we found was that 58% of the stores had flavored Cheyenne Little Cigars, 62% had flavored Cigarillos, 60% had flavored Snus, 52% had flavored Snuff. And kind of a more interesting, you see here that most of them were local stores. Only 23% were national stores, which included supermarkets that may sell tobacco products. The biggest bucket were the small markets or convenience stores, and we found that the emerging products, the price discounts, et cetera, were way more prevalent at the local stores. So I don't have my glasses, and this is really blurry, but if we look at, so flavored products were more prevalent at the local stores. So the first row really is that little, that Cheyenne example. So there were 274 stores that had valid data, yes or no. So of the 274 stores that responded to the Cheyenne question, 160 of them had the Cheyenne, so about 60%. But of the 160, 155 of them were local stores, so 97%. And this pattern follows through with every single flavored product. They are far more likely to be at a local store than a national store. Same thing with products more likely to be on the counter in local stores. So only about 10% of stores sampled had products directly on the counter. But you see the ranges here. 96 to 100% are in local stores as opposed to national stores. So again, your convenience store in the neighborhood, your local mom and pop store, etc., not your super stop and shop. Price promotions are more frequent at local stores. Again, anywhere from about 80% to 100%. The good news, we found no free gifts. So it was either special price or multi-pack discounts. Tobacco retailer proximity to schools, 12% were within 1,000 feet of a school with grades 6 or up. 75% of these retailers that were close to schools are the local stores, and the dense urban areas are at higher risk of having stores close to tobacco retailers. And three of our four core cities were the top hitters here, so Central Falls, Pawtucket, and Woonsocket. Providence is the other core city. And a core city means 25% of children live below the poverty threshold. So clear links to SES. Spatial summary of project findings. You see these blue dots? That's the buffer. So any retailer within 1,000 feet is represented by the blue dots. And generally when we present this, we blow up certain towns. But what we did was mark the stores that had products on the counter, the stores that had flavored products, etc., to provide a visual summary of the work that was completed. If you overlay income by census tract, we see the lighter areas are the lower income areas, which again have a higher retail density and are more likely to have the emerging products or have neighborhoods with schools vulnerable to tobacco retailers. So in conclusion, flavored, inexpensive, and emerging products are available in local stores frequented by our youth convenience stores. 75% of teens hit a convenience store for one thing or another. Products are placed where youth can see them. Schools in lower income communities are more likely to be within 1,000 feet of the buffer. But what was a lesson learned is that surveillance of the store environment is feasible. It's not easy. It comes with challenges, but you can get boots on the ground and go out and do it. Implications, store observation surveillance can mobilize stakeholders concerned about youth exposure to tobacco in their neighborhoods. Again, we monitor tobacco trends in real time. And most importantly, when you collect really good data and have stakeholder engagement, these data can be used to support local point of sale policies that may restrict the number of tobacco retailers in a certain area, the location, i.e. near schools, and the density of tobacco retailers. Maybe a town like Central Falls, which is a mile wide, should only have 5 retailers instead of 20. So again, these data are important to identify and drive the most needed point of sale interventions. Data quality is a big issue, so you have to be really clear about having a tool that is going to collect optimal data. Providence was excluded from the sampling frame, and we are bummed about that. Of course, this was a sample and didn't have all the retailers, and the goal was to repeat the study, but due to staff transition, that didn't happen. Project successes, tobacco control program, and our stakeholders felt like they better understood the retail environment. And it really did get people out there and people who were concerned about tobacco and they were concerned about health in their neighborhoods. Despite data quality issues, the collaboration with stakeholders and the work that was done was recognized by CDC and published as a success story on their website. And the practical experience was used to inform development of the standardized tool called STARS. So we intend to repeat this kind of surveillance with new tools and build on our lessons learned, increase use of GIS maps and more sophisticated spatial analysis, make sure we develop feedback loops so community partners can actually use the data, and provide TA so that partners can use the data to inform local point-of-sale policies. So just want to thank my co-authors who really did this work. I came into the program late and just did the ArcGIS stuff and tried to summarize it for them. And of course, this was initiated with funding support from CDC's Communities Putting Prevention to Work in 2010 to 2012. So that's my contact information. Any questions? I don't know where we are with time.
I don't really know much about snuff, you said. What's the difference in that and snuff? And I just briefly Googled it while you were presenting, and they said that there's some tobacco-less brands or types. How does that affect?
Tobacco-less snus?
Yeah.
I can't speak to tobacco-less snus. Can anyone else speak to that?
So probably some other product like use or e-cigarettes or that polymer that they were soaking in nicotine that they wanted people to suck on. That was being developed a few years ago. There's no such thing as tobacco-less.
Yeah. So I don't know how that would play into it. What's your other question?
What's the difference in that?
Snus is like a Listerine thing?
Or so traditionally snus is, instead of being fermented, like a lot of tobacco and stuff would be, snus is supposed to be pasteurized. It's not necessarily, I don't know how it's actually, that's in Sweden. In the U.S., so in Sweden, you know, it's refrigerated, because once you pasteurize something, bacteria can grow on it, most people hold. In the U.S., snus is not refrigerated. So basically in the U.S. snus is just tobacco and little sachets that you put in your mouth.
That's right.
But whether it's actually pasteurized or fermented or, you know, who knows what that is.
You mentioned the sign-up report. I was wondering if you did anything with like retailer violation rates with where the products were being placed.
No, not for this. So this kind of work can get kind of political. And so
try being in a tobacco state.
Yeah. The initial goal of this was to have youth go in and attempt to buy, and that presented a lot of problems, especially for a different agency that runs SINAR. We don't administer SINAR, and so there wasn't a lot of collaboration there. So there was nothing done with enforcement or violations. It was just strict observation. So
the questionnaire that you used, was that something that you guys developed and was it pilot tested, and did you have feedback about why you had so much missing data?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So it was developed based on a few kind of widely used tools at the time, like the store alert survey. It was pilot tested with focus groups, with our stakeholders, with key informant interviews. It seemed really straightforward at the time. It came with a user guide that was 10 pages long that explained every question. We worked with the agencies and trained them. They had like multiple training sessions and ongoing TA. And so when the data came back so incomplete, it was a mystery. And so the evaluator did follow up with the agencies and the staff that actually went out and collected, and there just wasn't a clear, like, it was random. It's like I couldn't see if they had that product over the counter. I got through 30% of my survey, and then the retailer started giving me the evil eye. There was a million different reasons. And what we learned was that we have to figure out like something else. Like, and the other thing is there was about, you know, it's front and back, so it doesn't seem like it's a lot. But it ends up being about 100 questions when you're like, do you have Cheyennes? Are they flavored? Are they on the counter? So we got to scale it down, was the take-home message. Mm-hmm.
If you were to redo this, would you reduce the size?
Reduce the size of the survey?
Questionnaire. Secondly, would you consider including a photo viewing from teens' height perspective to see the actually the viewing of the counter? Would you consider that?
How would we do that?
Taking a picture.
Oh, so them going in with like a camera and taking a picture? It's an option. I mean, I think at this point, one of the issues with this kind of work was that prior to the development of this standardized tool called STARS, everyone was doing it a different way and collecting all sorts of different things. And while that's good because people are going to have different point of sale policy priorities, we do need some kind of standardized tool to learn. So we are just going to opt to use the standardized tool and not correct our previous tool and start there and then build. So assessing eye level is by level is something that could come in the future, but not at this point.
Do you know if there's, so I guess the eye level is by level, and that's a weird thing, but so you said that the local stores were more likely to have sales and kind of promotional things.
Mm-hmm.
Do they get kickbacks or something
for that? They get promotional allowances from Big Tobacco. They sign contracts, and that's how Big Tobacco essentially leases that shelf space behind the counter. And you'll notice if you ever go into a convenience store, it's a power wall, right? You go in there and it's like tobacco, 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 and that is very strategic and, you know, done with these agreements. And they use branded shelves, et cetera. So there's some allowances.
Was there any thought to actually use the retailers to complete part of the survey or an additional?
That's a very interesting question. I don't know. As far as I know, the only way retailers were engaged was a very quick script to explain to them what was happening with the survey.
I mean, they're not. I mean, perceivably, they have a license. They can do this, so it's not like...
They can be, you know, doing things that are not legal with how they place tobacco. Mm-hmm.
And it will, in Rhode Island at least, it will vary by city and town and local ordinances that can restrict the placement of tobacco products.
And we did a similar study in Guam. I didn't directly do it, but someone involved. And we first of all had students from the local university, the University of Guam. They were our surveyors, and we rolled it into a course, so it made this table there. And we did collect data via pictures as well, using photo-based techniques. And also, there was a questionnaire involved, so just something to think about.
I want to give time for our last presenter and your second presentation.
Yeah, I have another presentation.
Yeah, so we can ask more questions.